You're listening to the Faith 2020 podcast, helping you see 2020 clearly through the lens of faith. Now here's your host, Michael Ware.
This is the Faith 2020 podcast. I am your host, Michael Ware. We're back for another episode oriented towards the general election. We have a presumptive nominee in Joe Biden, who is even more presumptive after the events of this week. We can presume even more that he'll be the nominee following a string of endorsements that he received on Monday. It was Senator Bernie Sanders. On Tuesday, it was President Barack Obama. And on Wednesday, Senator Elizabeth Warren endorsed the former vice president. He's received other endorsements throughout the week from Democratic elected officials and from Cardi B. And so that's been a theme of the week. I guess before we get to faith, the other significant update this week has been some state polling has come out that looks pretty good for the vice president. Not just some positive polling in the Rust Belt, but also in Arizona. And folks have been pointing out that if the vice president is able to win Arizona, then it allows him to lose Wisconsin and still win the 270 electoral votes he would need to become president. But there's been a lot of faith activity over the last few weeks. And this is the Faith 2020 podcast, and so I want to talk about it. Before we get into it, I just want to preview, we have a wonderful guest for this episode. Actually, this guest was recommended on Twitter and saw the recommendation and moved right away to book this man. I thought it was a wonderful idea. We have Professor Joel Goldstein with us, who's one of the preeminent scholars on the vice presidency. And I thought, what a great idea to get some historical perspective on the vice presidency, how presidential nominees have picked their vice president. Of course, the vice president hasn't always been selected by the nominee in such a direct way in American history, but in sort of the modern era, what kinds of criteria have guided that decision? How has the process been refined? To what extent is politics considered, electoral politics? And to what extent is it a pure sort of governing decision? We're going to talk with Professor Goldstein about all that and much more, and I'll tell you more about him before the interview. All right, let's talk about faith. Let's start on the side of the Trump campaign, which has been active. AP, the Associated Press, reported last week about Catholics for Trump, which will be a significant effort. It targeted not just towards white Catholics, but Hispanic Catholics and other Catholics as well, which is really significant. The AP article written by Elena Skor pointed out that they plan to focus, of course, on abortion and sanctity of life and Supreme Court nominations. They also made the argument that Trump's response to the coronavirus is an example of the Catholic principle of subsidiarity. So the Trump campaign has identified Catholics as a key constituency, and they are acting, as we've talked about on the show, as I continue to lay out, faith outreach is not that different from outreach to other constituencies. If you decide a constituency is important and needs to be spoken to and engaged directly, that will influence rhetoric. It will influence infrastructure of your campaign and staffing, and it will influence policy. And so just right there, Catholics for Trump material communicated out, press effort to get the word out there, rhetoric that is specifically oriented toward that community, and the infrastructure of the campaign, that they actually have a real effort. They're not just hoping Catholics know that President Trump wants their vote. They're saying it. Another example of this is the Washington Post reported just this week that the Trump campaign is dedicating resources to reaching out to Black and Hispanic evangelicals. And, you know, again, this is one of those areas where if you've been listening to this podcast, you won't be surprised by that. I get the sense that quite a few Democratic staffers and folks in decision-making positions in the party hand wave away the prospect of President Trump and the Trump campaign being effective with this effort. And they do so at great risk, explicitly in the report. Bishop Harry Jackson said right in the story, and Bishop Harry Jackson, I've known him for a decade and a half. He spoke at the first bipartisan event I hosted as a freshman. It was a college Democrat, George Washington University, college Democrats and college Republican co-sponsored event. And I had a panel that included everyone from Herb Silverman of, I think he was Americans United for Separation of Church and State or the Secular Coalition, something like that, to Bishop Harry Jackson. I think Rob Schenck was on the panel. Arthur Davis came by and gave remarks, the former congressman, Democratic congressman from Alabama. Bishop Harry Jackson was there. So I've known him since I was a kid. And he's been doing this for a long time. And he said exactly what his plan has been is what the Trump campaign is looking at, which is if we could pull away 5 to 7% of African-American voters, it's going to be a major hurdle to the Democrats. It's going to be a major boon for Trump. Now, with African-American voters. Hispanic voters is another thing. African-American voters, for that to happen, it takes not just Republican outreach. It takes Democratic malpractice. But what Democratic malpractice looks like is reaching out to African-Americans and thinking that you're appealing to African-Americans because DC advocacy groups like what you're saying. Well, you are disconnected from the actual issues, priorities, perspective of African-American voters. We saw this in the Democratic primary. One of the reasons why Joe Biden is the nominee today is because he understood that. The real test will be, can the Biden campaign hold on to that, even as they bring on staff to other campaigns and all kinds of advisors and consultants who didn't want Joe Biden to be the nominee in the first place now are telling the Biden campaign what's best for Joe Biden. And that's going to be a real test. On the Hispanic side, look, if Trump makes a concerted effort here, which, you know, let's be honest, Trump doing anything in a concerted way is a long shot. But if the campaign is methodical and disciplined, we could see Trump pick up among Hispanic voters overall, and particularly among Hispanic evangelicals and Catholics. 100%. Just watch what happens as this campaign and associated efforts pour in tens of millions of dollars into digital advertising that communicates a perspective that seems so inconsistent with Democratic caricatures or Democratic sort of narratives about President Trump. And then when they point out things like, you know, it doesn't seem like figures in the Democratic Party have great respect for your church, for the values you raise your kids with. Now, Joe Biden is insulated against that to a certain degree. It's one of the reasons why I've been optimistic about him being the nominee, which is that he is not someone who historically has approached voters generally with antagonism. And remember, this was the major critique of him during the Democratic primary. How dare he talk about Republicans he'll work with, and how dare he not condemn every person who disagrees with him, and how dare he express at some point in his career some level of moral nuance or hesitancy regarding his party's position on abortion and on life. And so that's another piece of this. You're going to have, and you're already seeing it. I'm not going to talk about Al Mohler's endorsement of Trump here. I wrote about it. I tweeted about it. So you could go on Twitter. That's free. That's available. I wrote an exclusive analysis piece for my subscribers on Substack. And if you want to check that out, would love to have you as a part of that community at reclaiminghope.substack.com. But Mohler just spends his, and others like him, you know, they spent this whole primary just revving up their people about, look at the Democratic Party. They got, you know, Beto O'Rourke, who wants to defund churches, and Bernie Sanders, who's a socialist, and these are the people leading the Democratic Party. How could you dare, you know, consider voting for them? Look what they're doing to Joe Biden. You know, there were even, you know, when Joe Biden wasn't doing too well, they were saying, like, look what they look what they're doing to poor Joe Biden, the only Democrat I could vote for. Of course, now that Joe Biden's the nominee, it's Joe Biden is the paragon of the Democratic Party. He's an example of how far left they've gone. No, I mean, look, I don't want to talk about this too much, because we at this point, we need to get through the convention. But one way to tell the story of this primary is, out of, you know, a dozen significant candidates, the Democratic Party selected the candidate with the most conservative record on abortion, with a record of striking a balance on religious freedom issues, with certainly a record of not being the antagonistic culture warrior, whatever, you know, caricature folks have of the Democratic Party on the right, whatever they use to scare folks. And to be clear, there is some of that in the Democratic Party. My point is that side didn't win. And so I know that's upsetting to that side. But what's funny is what happens in our politics is you get a conspiracy of the far left and the far right acting like they won even when they didn't win. The fact is, Biden, up to this point, won the primary without taking the policy stances that Elizabeth Warren had on abortion, or that Gillibrand had on abortion, or Kamala Harris had on abortion, or that Julian Castro had on abortion. And he won. He is the standard bearer. And so, you know, the far left has to deal with that, but the far right has to deal with that too. All right, let's wasn't planning on talking about some of that. I mean, just to put a bow on it, you know, the theme of that section of this episode was the Trump campaign is moving, and they've had a couple of bad weeks of polling, but, like, don't get it twisted. These folks may be, Donald Trump may be awful at governing. He has a campaign that's effective at reaching people. They're going to go at every angle that they see as an opportunity. And one of those angles is faith. And that's not just conservative white folks. They're going to be making a case across the board. And Democrats better be ready to have a response to that. Until the demographics of this country change wildly, you're not going to have a winning campaign unless you have a response, unless you're willing to make a case on that playing field. Thankfully, in my view, and from the perspective, I think, of people who don't want to see Trump get reelected, is the Biden campaign has done more on faith in the last 3 weeks than, and it's only a slight exaggeration when I say this, and, you know, it is an exaggeration, so please don't send me every link of everything Hillary Clinton did, you know,
starting in, you know, January of 2015. It's only a slight exaggeration to say that Joe Biden's campaign has done more on faith in the last 3 weeks than Hillary Clinton did in all of 2016. So they put out a new newsletter, and the first edition of that newsletter is just loaded with faith language. They put out a video and a statement around Easter that very appropriately, I think, lifted up the positive role that faith is playing in this crisis at a time, I'd add, when a lot of the media narrative is about churches that aren't closing down and not acknowledging the positive role that faith is playing in this crisis. Joe Biden put out a statement that suggests that is the beginning of a suggestion that he has a vision for a positive role that faith can play in American life and as part of a country where he is president. So he did that. Reverend William Barber, who has been a guest on this show, was one of the first guests on Joe Biden's podcast. They had a 45-minute conversation about faith. Now, their conversation about Reverend Barber's view on some of these issues isn't going to be shared by everybody. That's fine. Faith outreach isn't about only reaching out to one specific slice. It's about faith outreach. It is, again, you know, we said this around the cattle call event that Barber had, where I think he had 9 or 10 Democratic candidates show up. It's difficult to overstate how new it is to have a Democratic nominee engage in a 45-minute conversation about poverty. That's to Biden's credit. It's also a sign that Reverend Barber has, you know, for all the people who talk about building power and sort of we got a movement, dun, dun, dun. You know, Barber is pressing Biden on his own podcast on Barber's issues. And just like other constituencies do, the difference has been in the past, candidates have felt like they need to endure it with those constituencies and not endure it with faith community. And so it's significant. And so we've just seen a lot from the Biden campaign. And then, of course, President Obama endorsed, and I can talk about it a bit because it was made public, but I had the privilege of joining the president on President Obama on a prayer call. He a pretty private, intimate prayer call he held on during Holy Week. And when I say it was made public, there were excerpts of the call that were made public by the Obama Foundation of the portion of the call where the president was talking about faith community's response to coronavirus. And it was good to hear his voice. Second of all, I listened to the call, and, you know, you're torn between saying, you know, this is a once in a lifetime sort of leader that you're just never going to see again. And hearing them talk and just thinking, see, it's not that hard. You know, like, I'm not crazy. Like, what he is saying right now is what I've been suggesting y'all say, you know, since he left office. And it can be done. I'm hearing it right now. He is operating in the world as it is today, saying these things. Highest approval ratings in the Democratic Party of anybody. And, you know, and he's able to do it. And, you know, I won't go into the details, but he lays out a positive vision, inviting you into, inviting in this context, people of faith leaders, Christian leaders, acknowledging the good they're already doing, inviting them to do some more good together. Like it's not that difficult. And so when you're on that, when you're hearing that message, you're not hearing all these caveats of, you know it's hard sometimes for, you know, faith leaders to, you know, listen to science, but, you know, it's what we got to do. Instead, the president says exactly what's right on the call, which is, you know, he says, we know, and notice the pronoun, we know that there's no conflict between faith and science. So, like, yeah, there's some other nonsense going on, but these conflicts that we see aren't integral to faith. We don't need to give in to these false dichotomies, into these divisions. And the president brought some of that language to his endorsement of the vice president. Included was a quote that, quote, through all his trials, referring to Vice President Biden, he's never once forgotten the values or the moral fiber that his parents passed on to him and that made him who he is. That's what steals his faith in God, in America, and in all of us.
And look, like, that's just rhetoric. Like people shouldn't get, like, too euphoric over this, because, like, it makes us feel good. Like, oh, he's talking about faith in God. The practical value of something like this, the practical value of the vice president putting out an Easter statement, is it sends a message that Christians who want to talk about Easter, like Christians who will talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, Christians who believe that their faith is public and not just private, something that they should be able to talk about, shows that, like, there's a place for them. And that has policy implications. That has cultural implications. And those are substantive matters. Like, it matters. We could have had a candidate, and we have certain constituencies and people on the Democratic side who are like, why is the president, why would a Democratic nominee even issue a Easter statement? That's, you know, conflation of that breaks the separation of church and state. So, like, those arguments are happening. Joe Biden issuing a statement on Easter is a reflection of, like, where he falls, where his campaign falls on that side of the debate. So it's important. We don't listen to this rhetoric because it makes us feel all warm inside. We listen to it because it's an indication of how they'll govern and their vision of society. My last comment here, which, you know, goes to that, you know, so the vice president has a statement. He goes on Nicole Wallace's show on MSNBC, and he's talking about this. I think they aired the video. Nicole Wallace, interestingly, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but she asked a question that was something along the lines of, you know, what do you say about those who can't find faith in this moment, in the coronavirus, that you know, see the bad news and are worried and can't find faith. Interestingly, and it shows a certain kind of, like, sensitivity that's and guardedness that has crept in just generally into society. I didn't hear her asking that question as, you know, I'm not a person of faith, so what do you have to say to me? But that's kind of how Biden took it. And Biden gave an answer that was like, you know, basically saying, you know, for me, faith is important, but for you, it might be, you know, the smile on your kid's face, or, you know, I'd be happy to talk with a former vice president about that. That is not really the point. The point is, there was this interesting thing that happened where some of his supporters shared Biden's response as if to say, this is why I support Joe. Like, faith really isn't about religion so much. Faith is not so integral after all. So they go, they put out the statement, they do the video. Vice President's on MSNBC talking about how he'd say three Hail Marys with his kids every night and pray on his rosary, and how his faith, his Catholic faith, got him through. And, you know, what some folks on the campaign shared was, you know, him responding to what he thought was a question in a way full of empathy, you know, whatever. We could talk about the particularities of what he said, whether, you know, from a theological perspective, you parse it out like he did. The point is, this, you know, someone said this, you know, it's Easter week. So, like, why are you using official channels? Like if you can't let off, like, a clean hit of a vice president just talking about his faith, like, you know, 2 days before Easter, you know, when is that going to be okay? And so it was just an interesting moment. It shows, like, a discomfort among some with not having a caveat around speaking from your perspective. You know, let's say we were talking about a candidate speaking about how their background being raised in a low-income family shaped who they are or influences their thought. Or I can't even talk about how their racial background has affected their life and how they think about things. There would be no demand on that candidate to say, well, what I learned, you know, growing up low income was, you know, hard work, you know, the importance of community. But, you know, I just want to be clear, not suggesting that my upbringing was any better than anybody else's. And, you know, my upbringing isn't the only way that you could raise someone. And it's what's important to you. You don't need to universalize everything. So, yeah, I guess the main message I have here is don't step on your own messaging. It's Holy Week. You know, Vice President said what he said. And you don't got to apologize for it. He's a very, like, let it speak for itself. You don't need to do all kinds of explaining for him on something like this. All right, so just to recap what we've discussed, and I feel like I haven't talked to you in a while and really given a overview of where things are, so I felt like this episode would be a good one to do it. Just as an overview, both campaigns are turning towards a general. I mean, even to the extent that, you know, Biden's week has largely been defined by these endorsements, but the Democratic endorsements are about pivoting to the general. And so that's happening on faith too. Just over the last couple of weeks, two major stories, one in the AP, one in Washington Post, about Trump's outreach to Catholics and evangelicals of color. The Biden campaign has been a pretty faith forward. Part of that is just due to the fact that that, you know, we just had Easter, Passover. The Biden campaign did some good work around Passover as well. But it also indicates a different approach, a correction from 2016. Certainly a long way to go, a lot of work to do, but I feel like the Biden campaign is on a good trajectory. I'm interested to see, you know, they're staffing up now, that they're pivoting towards the general. They could use some additional faith staff. It's a big country. There's a lot of folks to reach out to, a lot of different angles to cover. And now that they're moving towards a general, staffing up here is appropriate and I think necessary. So over the next 4 to 8 weeks, I'll be interested to see some additional faith hires. All right, let's move to our interview this week. And we're going to be talking to Professor Joel Goldstein. Joel is a highly respected scholar of the vice presidency, the presidency, and constitutional law, has written widely in all three areas. He is sought by national and international media outlets to provide commentary and insight during the presidential campaigns, as we're doing here at the Faith 2020 podcast. He is probably best known for his work on the vice presidency, which is why we have him on. He wrote his first book, which was based on his doctoral dissertation on the modern American vice presidency, the transformation of a political institution. He wrote a second book on the subject, the White House vice presidency, the path to significance, Mondale to Biden. And he's written numerous scholarly articles and commentary pieces on the vice presidency. He is, as he'll tell us, he's currently working on a book on the national political career of Senator Edmund Muskie, which I'm really interested in and glad that we're able to talk about that towards the end of the interview. Professor Goldstein is just immensely respected, a great honor to have him on. Here's my conversation with Professor Joel Goldstein. Well, Professor Goldstein, welcome to the Faith 2020 podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
Yeah, you know, as we obviously, you know, up until the last month or so, this podcast has been focused on the primary process. But we now feel, especially after the events of this week, we feel confident pivoting to the general election. And I just thought, who better to have on to help us understand the vice presidency, and particularly the selection process for the vice president in sort of the modern era, and what might be going through the former vice president Joe Biden's mind as he thinks about who his running mate should be. Who better to walk us through some of that than you? So again, thank you so much for joining us. Where I'd like to start is just tell us a bit, sort of as an overview about sort of how you've seen in the modern era, sort of particularly post Kennedy and post Kennedy, how the Kennedy presidency, how have you seen the vice presidency evolve over the last, say 60, 70 years? What has the vice presidency become in America?
Sure. It's a fascinating story of how an institution can evolve. I mean, historically, the vice presidency was a pretty insignificant office. John Adams, the first vice president, said that my country has created for me the most insignificant office that ever the imagination of man conceived. I can do neither good nor evil. And really, for most of our history, the vice presidency was pretty much limited to presiding over the Senate. And on rare occasions, when a president would die, the vice president would become president. But it was really very much of sort of a afterthought, of a laughingstock that was disparaged by not only by political pundits and comedians, but by vice presidents as well. Thomas Marshall, who was Woodrow Wilson's vice president after he retired, said, "I don't want to work anymore, but I wouldn't mind being vice president again." The office really began to change in the mid 20th century. Really, America's role in the world, American government, had changed really due to the New Deal and World War II, the advent of the Cold War, the nuclear age, and just the change in technology. And that had sort of made the presidency more important, made America's role in the world more important. And so what really happened, beginning with the Eisenhower presidency and the vice presidency of Richard Nixon, was the vice presidency really was pulled away from Capitol Hill into the executive branch. And the vice president really gradually became sort of somebody who took on assignments for the president, political and diplomatic assignments for the president, and spent less and less time presiding over the Senate. And for about a quarter century, beginning with the vice presidency of Richard Nixon, that model sort of followed. But then the office took another sort of major shift with the vice presidency of Walter Mondale in 1977. President Carter really brought Mondale into the president's inner circle for the first time. Mondale sort of envisioned a new kind of vice presidency. Carter blessed it, and that really is what developed during their term. And then it's really been followed, with some variation ever since by Democratic and Republican administrations both.
Yeah, as I was preparing for this, for our conversation, I was thinking, I think it's easy to and almost assume sort of a kind of cynicism when it comes to the choice of a running mate, that, oh, it's a purely sort of political thing. They're just looking to balance the ticket or this and that. But then I thought about the recent vice presidents that we've had, Nixon, George H.W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Joe Biden. These were not, in many of the cases, these were not the most sort of politically attractive figures that the nominee could have selected. And then second,
Also throw in LBJ there. But second, these were real heavyweights. These were people who knew how government worked, who could get things done. Do you also push back on sort of, do you see in history sort of evidence to push back against the idea that nominees are looking at this solely through a political lens? And how do you, I guess the more specific question is, how do you think they've balanced the two, the electoral politics of it and the fact that they're going to have to govern with this person for at least 4 years?
Sure. No, I think that's a great question. It's a great point because the people who've been vice president, beginning with Nixon, and you could actually go back a little bit further. I mean, Harry Truman's vice president, Alvin Barkley, was a major figure in the Senate and so forth. But starting with Richard Nixon, with very few exceptions. I mean, Spiro Agnew, I think, would be one. The people who've been vice president have really been at the top of their political generation. I mean, whether you are a D or an R, whether you agree with them or not, folks like Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Gerald Ford, Nelson Rockefeller, Mondale, Bush, so forth. I mean, we're really political heavyweights who were, the blue chip players of their party during their time. Your point about vice presidential selection, I think you're quite right. I mean, there is something cynical about suggesting, as often is, that presidential candidates are simply going to be looking for somebody from a big state to bring in a big block of electoral votes. But, in fact, that's not how it operates. Many of the vice presidential candidates have been folks from small states. Dick Cheney was from Wyoming with 3 electoral votes. Joe Biden from Delaware with 3 electoral votes. Sarah Palin from Alaska. Joe Lieberman from Connecticut. And very rarely do presidential candidates choose somebody from a big competitive state. Gerald Ford chose Bob Dole from Kansas. Well, if Ford wasn't going to win Kansas, he wasn't going to have a chance of being reelected to begin with. And Dan Quayle from Indiana, again, a state that, that the Republicans had to win to have a chance. So there are very few instances where the state makes a big difference. I think that one of the insights that President Jimmy Carter had when he ran for president in 1976 was that the idea that there was a relationship between making a good governance decision and a good political decision. I think, Walter Mondale certainly had certain sort of ticket balancing appeal to Carter. Carter was a Southerner. Mondale was a Northerner. Carter was more moderate. Mondale identified with the liberal part of the Democratic Party. Carter, his experience had been a one-term governor of Georgia. Mondale had 12 years of experience in Washington. Carter was sort of an outsider. Mondale was somebody who was well-liked by the traditional Democratic groups. But Carter also saw Mondale as somebody who really was a very substantial person and who could help him govern. And I think he realized that if you chose somebody who was presidential, that they were more likely to do well on the campaign trail and that was more likely to reflect well on the person who made the selection than if you chose somebody who might have the right sort of check off the right boxes, but might be less able. And so I think many presidents have really thought long and hard and have been motivated in part, many presidential candidates, by choosing somebody who really is presidential, not simply because it's good governance, although it is, but they've also seen that choosing somebody who is going to be a plausible president is also smart politically.
Yeah, that's helpful. Looking at 2020 and specifically at former Vice President Biden, what do you think he's especially paying attention to as he
considers this decision? What do you think history would advise him to pay attention to, in addition to what you just laid out? And then, you know, also to sort of add to the pot, and you could just sort of reflect on Biden's choice, however you wish. But my understanding is it is a bit of a novelty in presidential politics for Biden to have laid so many of his cards out on the table at this point. He is committed in a presidential debate to selecting a woman as his vice president, as his running mate. He's been quite specific about some of the people he's considering. How do you think that plays into it? Were you surprised for Biden to make such an explicit promise at the stage of the campaign that he did?
Well, I was surprised. I mean, I had written some months before he had made that statement that I thought that, you know, it's at some point we'll get to a point where there'll be two women on a Democratic ticket, and I think there'll be two white men on a Democratic ticket again. And of course, in the past, I mean, with the exception of a very few tickets, our presidential tickets have been two white men. But that I thought that we're now at a stage where it was likely that there would be some sort of demographic balance on the Democratic ticket, so that I thought that if a woman were the presidential nominee, that she would choose a running mate who was a man, and that I thought that if the nominee was a person of color, that they would choose somebody who was Caucasian. And so I thought that there would be some sort of demographic balance. I thought that a white male candidate would choose either a woman or a minority. I was surprised when the vice president indicated up front that his running mate was going to be a woman.
Right.
It narrows his pool. I mean, it's a very different terrain than when Walter Mondale chose in 1984. There's I think 17 women, Democratic women in the United States Senate. There are six women who are Democratic governors, many women who served in President Obama's cabinet and so forth. So there's a lot of able people. A number of women ran for president this time. There's a lot of people in the pool to choose from. I think that if what history would suggest, and my view is that you have to start by choosing somebody who's presidential. I think it's a mistake to choose somebody who reachable voters, voters who might be persuaded to vote for you, don't view as somebody who they could see plausibly sitting in the Oval Office. So I think you have to start with asking, is this somebody who really is of the caliber to serve as president of the United States? I think another sort of threshold factor is that the candidates have to go through a very intensive vetting screen that really asks about everything in their life, their families' lives, their spouse, their children, and to sort of smoke out whether there's anything that would, any baggage that they might have that is just too heavy to risk bearing in a campaign. If you get through past those two hurdles, I think then what you're thinking about is this somebody who I can work with? Is this somebody who I'm politically compatible with, so that we'll be articulating messages that are compatible? Is this somebody that is a human being that I'm personally compatible with? Is this somebody who is suited to function as a number two? Being a vice president or vice presidential candidate is really an extraordinary position, and it's a very difficult one. I mean, you imagine a fellow like Biden, who for 36 years, he's a United States senator. He's chairman of two major committees. He's his own boss. And then he spends 8 years where his assignment basically is to help somebody else, you know, basically pursue his agenda. And of course, you were there. And so it's a very different, it's a difficult role. For a vice presidential candidate, you can't simply think about, what do I think about this issue? You have to be thinking about what is the theme, what does the presidential candidate think about it? What has he or she said about it? How can I say something that's consistent with that? And so it's a challenging role. And the vice presidential candidate's got to be somebody who's willing to perform in that role. And then, of course, you're thinking about, you know, to be president, you have to get 270 electoral votes. So running up the popular vote isn't going to get you across the finish line. You basically have to think, is there somebody who can help me in a competitive state, maybe make a little bit of a difference, help me at the margin that might make the difference between carrying one of the states that's likely to be competitive. I think those are the major factors. There's some other smaller factors. I mean, you know, there's some states where some of the people who've been mentioned are senators from states that have Republican governors. So if they were elected, it would cost the Democrats a seat in the Senate. You know, that may be a consideration that you think about as well. But I think these other ones would be the primary ones.
Yeah, I guess before we wrap up, I would love to ask you about, you know, the role Vice President Pence has played and the role that you see him playing in the upcoming reelection fight. You know, it's been interesting to see the role he's been given in combating and dealing with the coronavirus. He was viewed in 2016 as someone who provided a sense of familiarity and comfort to, in particular, social conservatives who might otherwise, didn't have that comfort necessarily, or at least that sort of cultural familiarity with Donald Trump back then. How do you think he's done as vice president? How closely to the historical model has his vice presidency, you know, followed? And then do you think he's a piece of the puzzle for Donald Trump's reelection effort?
I think all the vice presidents, beginning with Mondale, have sort of followed the what I've called the White House vice presidency, but it's really the model that Carter and Mondale created of the vice president as a general across the board advisor and troubleshooter for the president on significant matters that need high level attention. Right. You know, there's been some variation from administration to administration, depending upon the talents of the particular vice president, the needs of the president, and his administration. And the relationship between the two, the vice president's standing at a particular time, and the president's decision-making style. I mean, if you're working for a president like Jimmy Carter, who takes a deep sort of dive into issues, there's a lot of opportunity to engage in sort of policy discussions. And there may be opportunities because Carter wasn't really particularly focused on the politics of policy to make real contributions in that area. Right. On the other hand, if you're the vice president for Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, sort of focused on big picture, you may not have the same opportunity to, you know, to take these, you know, deep dives into policy. But George H.W. Bush, who was a very talented diplomat, did a lot of important sort of diplomatic work for President Reagan. And so each vice president is a little bit different depending upon the vice president's skills, the president's personality, and decision-making style. I think one of the challenges that Vice President Pence has had is, I think Vice President Pence has basically followed this Mondale model. Yeah. I think his vice presidency, of course, is sort of refracted by the fact that you know, he's working for a pretty unique president in Donald Trump. President Trump has,
Is that the historic assessment at this pretty unique? Is that the academic term to put around it?
I think that's as neutral a way as I can express it, I think. I think it's, President Trump doesn't engage in the same sort of policy processes that our other presidents have of both parties. He, you know, tends to talk to and to take information from people who other presidents would not have spent time talking about on the talking to on the phone, whether they're sort of business cronies or people who have shows on political talk shows or that sort of thing. And you know, and he sets policy sometimes by Twitter. You know, and he's been somebody who's been surrounded by controversy, a lot of investigations and so forth. For most vice presidents, they've wanted to be in the room at all the time. Well, it's pretty difficult to be in the room when policy is made. If policy is made, you know, up in the White House residence during a phone conversation with Sean Hannity, or if policy is made on a tweet that comes at 6 a.m. or whenever. So Vice President Pence has had some constraints. I think there's also the sense that this is a president who particularly rewards subordinates who are willing to praise him rather effusively. And that's been something that the vice president has done. The coronavirus task force has really been the most significant assignment of an ongoing sort of nature that Vice President Pence has had since he was brought in to play an important role in the transition. And so presumably he's running the task force meetings, although, you know, the presentation, the results now has turned into sort of a daily briefing where the president, you know, comes in and takes over. I think one of the problems that Vice President Pence has is that for a vice president to be really significant, it's got to be clear to other people that the president really values him, and that the president, and that when the vice president speaks, he's speaking for the president. There have been a number of instances where President Trump has, after Vice President Pence has taken actions or made statements, has undercut him or has said things that were different. And when that happens, it tends to devalue the vice president's significance in the eyes of other people. You know, if the vice president can't speak for the president, well, then you'd much rather, why speak to the vice president? And so I think that's been a challenge that he's had on occasion. I think that President Trump has indicated that Vice President Pence will be his running mate. He's even said it would be very disloyal for him not to include Vice President Pence. A number of times he's mentioned the fact that Vice President Pence is somebody who has support in the evangelical community. So I would think that I'd be very surprised if Vice President Pence isn't on the ticket with President Trump.
Yeah. Well, Joel, I can't thank you enough for providing this insight that's going to really help us over especially these next few months, but going into the general. Would love for, we were able to talk before we started recording, would love for you to share a bit about your current book project and what are you working on?
Well, the next big project that I'm working on, I'm still doing some work on the vice presidency and issues dealing with presidential succession and inability. But the big project that I'm really excited about and focused on is a political biography of Senator Edmund Muskie in his national career. Muskie was a two-term governor of Maine, who then went to the United States Senate from 1959 until he resigned from the Senate to become Secretary of State in 1980. He was the Democratic vice presidential candidate in 1968. But he really was somebody who came from a tradition and practiced the art of bipartisan politics. When he was the governor of Maine, the legislature was controlled overwhelmingly by Republicans, and he got used to working across the aisle, as he had when he'd been in the Maine legislature as a minority member. When he went to the Senate, he became a subcommittee and committee chairperson, but he was somebody who always worked very closely with the Republican ranking member. And oftentimes, although Muskie was really identified as a liberal, he would work very closely with people like Howard Baker or Henry Bellman, or others who were much more conservative, and they would work collaboratively to come up with legislation, including, for instance, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, major environmental accomplishments of the 1970-72 period were overwhelmingly bipartisan accomplishments. And this took place at the committee level and on the floor of the Senate. And it was really due to that sort of approach to politics. In his national campaign in 1968, he really articulated beautifully the basic values of American pluralism and the idea that we're a people that that is enriched by the fact that there's a diversity of views and nationalities, yeah, and ethnic groups and religious groups and racial groups, and that's part of what makes us strong, and that's part of who we are. And we need to work together, and we need to trust each other. And so that's really the next project, and I'm really excited about it, and I appreciate you asking about it.
Well, it's timely. I wish we could talk about it more. I will say just the one thought that has hit me is, I'm not sure there is a huge stable of political figures that we could call on to serve on something like the Tower Commission. if as you talk about Muskie, it seems like we could use people like him, but they don't grow on trees.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, people like Muskie and Howard Baker, and they were the sort of people who could be called on by presidents of the other party, and they always put nation first, and they may have disagreed with some other people, whose politics were different, but they had no question of that the priority was on what's in the best interest of the United States of America, and they were disposed to work with people who they disagreed with, and they thought that good policy was formed by interacting with people who they disagreed with and engaging in civil discourse. And so they really were treasures.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that work from you. I'm grateful for all of your work. And thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Oh, not at all. Thanks very much for having me. I enjoyed being with you.
Thank you. Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Professor Joel Goldstein. An honor to have him on. Grateful for really his lifetime of work into the subject and his willingness to share that insight with us. That's all we have for you this week on the Faith 2020 podcast. I would love to stay in touch on Twitter. I'm at Michael R. Ware, over on Substack at reclaiminghope.substack.com. And we'll talk on the next episode of the Faith 2020 podcast.